recognition for a Palestinian state.
Today, Ireland, Norway, and Spain are announcing that we recognize the state of Palestine.
A state dinner at the White House for the president of Kenya.
We mark the 60th anniversary of the United States partnership with Kenya with an elegant dinner under the stars in a pavilion made almost entirely of glass, looking up at our one sky.
And a new airline that's going to the dogs.
A first class experience for the dog, a business class experience for people.
Today is Thursday, May 23rd. And this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Three European nations say they will recognize Palestine as a state.
Today, Ireland, Norway, and Spain are announcing that we recognize the state of Palestine. Each of us will now undertake whatever national steps are necessary to give effect to that decision. In the lead up to today's announcement, I've spoken with a number of other leaders and counterparts, and I'm confident that further countries will join us in taking this important step in the coming weeks. This is an historic and important day for Ireland and for Palestine.
That's Irish Prime Minister Simon Harris, who went on to explain Ireland's own first-hand experience of being recognized by the world.
Taking our place on the world stage and being recognized by others as having the right to be there was a matter of the highest importance for the founders of our state.
And he addressed the citizens of Israel directly.
To the people of Israel, I say today, Ireland is resolute and unequivocal in fully recognizing the state of Israel and Israel's right to exist securely and in peace with its neighbors. Let me be clear that Ireland condemns the barbaric massacre carried out by Hamas on the 7th of October last. Civilians attacked, murdered, hostages taken in the most brutal and terrifying of circumstances, including a young Israeli-Irish child. We call again for all hostages to be immediately returned to the arms of their loved ones.
An emotional Riyad Mansour, Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations.
It is a wonderful omen as we assemble today that we received very positive news from Europe that Spain, Ireland, and Norway declared today that they will be recognizing the state of Palestine on the 28th of this month.
Israel's reaction was swift. That's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying that giving Palestinian statehood is a reward for terrorism and that most Palestinians supported the October 7th attack. In the United States, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan gave the U.S. position on the announcement.
Each country is entitled to make its own determinations, but the U.S. position on this is clear. President Biden, as I just said, has been on the record supporting a two-state solution. He has been equally emphatic on the record that that two-state solution should be brought about through direct negotiations through the parties, not through unilateral recognition. That's a principled position that we have held on a consistent basis. We'll communicate that to our partners around the world, and we'll see what unfolds.
So what does this really mean? Let's try and make some sense of it. Joining us to help do just that is Michael Provence, who teaches modern Middle East history, focusing on the 20th century Arab East at the University of California, San Diego. So let's start right at the top. What do you think of the, what's your first impression of hearing the news?
Well, it's a positive development from the perspective of a future of peaceful coexistence in historic Palestine, I would say. It's long overdue, and it's kind of interesting and I think notable that the countries that first did this are Norway, which, you know, has a long history of brokering peace with between the Israelis and Palestinians in the Oslo Accords of the 90s, Ireland, which has a colonial history of its own with Britain at about the same time that the Palestine conflict was born in 1917, and Spain. So, it's interesting. It also, you know, is, of course, just yesterday we had the International Criminal Court, or day before yesterday, the International Criminal Court, with indictments against Netanyahu and Hamas leaders. And these are all kind of the issue that unites these discussions are the issue of equality of presentation, or what Edward Said called permission to narrate, which is the symmetry between the claims and the rights of Israelis and Palestinians. So it's pretty interesting.
Of course, the United States and Israel protested loudly, and then, you know, tried to say, and what they're saying, what Israel's saying is it rewards Hamas for terrorism. But, you know, it's kind of a chicken or the egg question, isn't it?
It sure is.
You know, yeah. If there had been a Palestinian state, would there have been a Hamas?
Right. Well, that's a very good point and a good question. And, you know, the issue, like I say, is the issue of representation. So are the Palestinians, do they have the same rights to their homeland as Israelis have? And if the answer to that question is yes, then they have to be recognized. And if the answer to that question is yes, I mean, so essentially what Netanyahu and what President Biden are insisting on is that Israeli rights are superior, or maybe even non-coexistent with Palestinian rights, to life, to liberty, to freedom, to representation, to the land, to anything. And, you know, once you begin to discuss that, it's not a sustainable position. So this is the source of the outrage from the Israeli government and from the Biden administration, not only for the recognition of the state of Palestine by these three EU countries, but also the fact that the International Criminal Court indicted these Israeli statesmen at the same time that it indicted Hamas leaders. And they objected most strongly, the Israelis, that is, Netanyahu, to the symmetry, or what they called the comparison between the two. But, I mean, this is actually as it should be. The rights of these two peoples to this territory have to be considered equally, I would say, in order for there to ever be any kind of solution that offers justice to anybody.
Does this move the needle at all toward a two-state?
Well, it makes it more difficult the effort to delay the discussion of Palestinian rights in perpetuity, and to push it always down the road and to say, they're not ready, they're terrorists, we don't have a partner for peace, there's no one to talk to, they never miss a chance to miss a chance, or never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. All these things are evasions that that make the serious, forthright discussion of Palestinian rights to their own country equal to Israeli rights to their own country, not part of the discussion. And so, you know, so these things do change. They do move the needle, as you say, by making those kinds of claims more difficult for people like Netanyahu, but also for the American government, also for President Biden.
Well, they tried to move that resolution in the United Nations to give them membership, and the United States vetoed in Security Council. Does it make it difficult for the U.S. to do those kind of things, or does the U.S. just stand firm for how long?
If the U.S., well, I mean, it is. We can easily envision a world in which the United States and Israel are completely isolated, and that they have actually no countries that support their position. And for the United States, that shouldn't be a diplomatic international position that anybody should consider desirable. So if the other EU states join these three initial countries, which I think is likely, then the horizon for any kind of block, of diplomatic block of countries that will be perennially supportive of whatever Israeli position the Israeli government takes is, you know, that's finished. That's not going to. And then it's just the United States. And if it's only the United States that defends the Israeli position and no other country will do that diplomatically in these international, then what that means is that the international institutions themselves either have no value. So if the United States wants to undermine the UN, the World Bank, the World Food Program, and the International Criminal Court, and a whole range of other things, it's within its power to do that. But that is not in the long-term interest of the United States on any level, because it dominates all of those institutions. So if it tells the world these things don't matter because we don't pay any attention to them when it suits us not to pay any attention to them, then, you know, we can see where that leads. So at some point, the United States will have to either agree with its other allies that Israel needs to be treated like any other state and pressured to deal with its occupied Palestinian population equitably, or at least allow them to represent themselves on equal terms, or else, like I say, we have a future of increasing diplomatic and probably economic and political isolation for both Israel and for the United States.
Thanks so much for the time.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Michael Provins from the University of California, San Diego. Humanitarian aid for Gaza still not flowing through the gated Rafah since Israel took control of the border crossing. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken urging Egypt to do everything it can to get more aid into the Strip.
I think there are two things that are going on. One is, yes, it's important, I think, politically for the Egyptians to show that they are a critical actor in providing assistance. At the same time, because of combat activities around, near and around the gate, the environment for bringing the assistance in is really challenged. And so we need to find a way to make sure that the assistance that would go through Rafah can get through safely.
Egyptian security sources say Egypt opposes Israel's presence at the Rafah crossing and wants it to withdraw. We're following these other stories from around the world. China sending lethal aid to Russia for use in its war against Ukraine. That's what British Defense Minister Grant Shapps said on Wednesday. Shapps warned that NATO needed to wake up and bolster defense spending across the alliance. French President Emmanuel Macron landed on the Pacific island of New Caledonia on Thursday for a day of talks, during which he will aim to turn the page on deadly riots triggered by a contested electoral reform. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has set July 4th for a national election as his divided and demoralized Conservative Party looks likely to lose power after 14 years. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, Pennsylvania is one of a handful of U.S. states that could determine the outcome of November's election. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns looks at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump are doing to win there.
Pennsylvania is a large, politically divided state that could go either way in this election. Michael Sansis teaches political science at Pennsylvania's Temple University.
We went for Donald Trump in 2016. We went for Joe Biden in 2020. And at both times, it was a difference of, you know, 40,000 votes or 80,000 votes in a state of millions of people. So we're closely divided.
Sansis says Pennsylvania voters' top concerns in this election are the economy and immigration.
There's a lot of talk among Biden's folks trying to highlight the positives in the economy. It still doesn't seem to have really caught on with the general public, so they're still very concerned about the economy. People are concerned about immigration and the southern border, even though Pennsylvania is nowhere near the southern border.
Trump campaigning in Pennsylvania includes attacking Biden border policies and clean energy initiatives.
To think about what we have to go through and the things we put up with the border, with no energy independence, with all electric cars. Would everybody like to buy an electric car for the rest of your life?
Electric vehicles and Chinese imports are sensitive issues in a state where union voters are politically active and organized. Biden this month quadrupled import duties on Chinese electric vehicles, saying unfair competition is cheating U.S. workers.
I'm determined that the future of electric vehicles will be made in America by union workers, period.
Trump told Pennsylvania gun owners that Biden lacks the character to serve another 4 years.
Joe Biden is the worst and most incompetent and most corrupt president in the history of our country.
Biden grew up in the Pennsylvania city of Scranton and campaigns on those local working class roots, portraying Trump as someone who he says, quote, bows down to billionaires.
We all know guys like that growing up. My vision of America is one of hope and opportunity. The view from Scranton, working class Americans like you.
Biden running mate and Vice President Kamala Harris campaigned in Pennsylvania this week, her fourth visit this year.
We believe in the promise of America, a promise of freedom, equity, opportunity, and justice, not just for some, but for all.
She said Pennsylvania voters should not be misled by Trump and his allies.
In this moment, extremists are trying to divide our nation. And we see them as they encourage xenophobia and hate.
Trump told Pennsylvanians that he'll regain America's standing.
We will restore American strength at home. We were respected 4 years ago all over the world. Today, we are considered a joke. It's not going to be for long.
Political polling by the Philadelphia Inquirer this month shows Biden and Trump in a statistical tie in Pennsylvania, with lower support for Biden among both young and non-white voters compared to 4 years ago. Both of those groups were central to Biden winning the state in 2020. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
The White House rolled out the red carpet for the first African leader to be hosted for a state visit since 2008. Kenyan President William Ruto is getting a lavish state dinner and some deals. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
The White House gave VOA its three reasons for choosing Kenya's president to break the nearly 16-year drought during which no African leader has been honored with a state visit. These include the two governments' shared democratic convictions and their like-minded approach in leveraging the private sector. The primary reason, the administration's new top Africa policymaker told VOA, is Kenya's recent decision to assert itself globally by offering 1,000 security officers for Haiti. Frances Brown is senior director for African affairs at the National Security Council. She sat down with VOA this week for her first media interview since taking the job earlier this month.
We chose Kenya for a few reasons. Number one is the Kenya-U.S. partnership has really grown from a regionally focused one to a globally focused one. So we've been really pleased the way the Kenyans have stepped up to play leadership beyond their region.
Analysts say a state visit is a big deal. Cameron Hudson is a senior fellow in the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
It is the highest diplomatic honor that our president can bestow. It is typically an indicator of a very close and important bilateral relationship. And so elevating Kenya to the level of, let's say, a Japan, which was the most recent country to have a state visit, I think is symbolic.
Anita Powell, VOA News. The White House.
And finally, Bark Air is set for its maiden Dogs Fly first flight from New York to Los Angeles, planned for Thursday. The company has a mission to fly dogs of all sizes, and their people, in comfort and style. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino runs it down for us.
On this airplane, dogs like Billy the Corgi are ditching the kennels for first class.
It's a first class experience for the dog, a business class experience for people.
That's the mission for Bark Air. It caters to dogs of all sizes and their people.
Hello, Hazy.
CEO Matt Meeker said the idea was 10 years in the making, after struggling to find a way to transport his Great Dane.
I was unable to travel with him long distances and had the idea of that there should be an airline that caters to dogs of his size and of this size to travel with their people in comfort, not in a duffel bag, not in a cargo hold, but treated as a member of the family. We cater everything to the dog, trying to lower their anxiety and their stress so they have the most comfortable, fear-free experience on an airplane.
The dog-first experience starts with a waiting lounge filled with treats and a speedy check-in. Bark Air also offers an onboard spa for the pups and a luxurious menu featuring doggy champagne
and they get a little pup cup
and barkachinos. The company aims to sell 10 tickets per flight to make room for 10 dogs, though the luxury aircraft can accommodate up to 15 people. Tickets for one person and one dog cost $8,000 for a one-way international flight or $6,000 for domestic trips. Meeker says those numbers could come down in the future.
We're operating at a loss today as we start. The idea is over time, we have a pretty clear pathway to lower the price for the consumer and lower our costs. And that comes with scale and more routes. And so we wanted to start at a place where we could measure if there was demand, and it seems there is.
Currently, Bark Air routes include flights between New York City, Los Angeles, and London. The company is now considering adding flights to Paris, Milan, Chicago, Seattle, and seasonal destinations in Florida and Arizona after receiving 15,000 requests for new destinations.
I hope that we can create an experience that reaches every family that wants to travel with their entire family like they do with their children.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for spending this time with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States rejects the announcement of the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, or ICC, that he is applying for arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his defense minister, Yoav Gallant, as well as three leaders of Hamas on charges of war crimes, said State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller in a briefing.
There should be no equivalence between Israel and Hamas. None. Hamas is a brutal terrorist organization that carried out the worst massacre of Jews since the Holocaust and is still holding dozens of innocent people hostage, including Americans.
Furthermore, the ICC has no jurisdiction over this matter, said spokesperson Miller.
The ICC was established by its state parties as a court of limited jurisdiction. These limits are rooted in principles of complementarity, which do not appear to have been applied here, amid the prosecutor's rush to seek these arrest warrants, rather than allowing the Israeli legal system a full and timely opportunity to proceed.
In other situations, the prosecutor deferred to national investigations and worked with states to allow them time to investigate. The prosecutor did not afford the same opportunity to Israel in this case, which has ongoing investigations into allegations against its personnel, noted Mr. Miller. There are also deeply troubling process questions. Despite not being a member of the court, Israel was prepared to cooperate with the prosecutor and had made that clear, said Mr. Miller. In fact, the prosecutor himself was scheduled to visit Israel to discuss the investigation and hear from the Israeli government. But the prosecutor's staff didn't get on their flight around the same time that the prosecutor himself went on television to announce these charges. These circumstances call into question the legitimacy and credibility of this investigation, declared spokesperson Miller. Finally, this decision does nothing to help and could jeopardize ongoing efforts to reach a ceasefire agreement that would get hostages out of Gaza and surge humanitarian assistance in, warned Mr. Miller.
Those are the goals that the United States is pursuing and will continue to pursue despite these actions by the ICC prosecutor.
President Joe Biden called the application for arrest warrants against Israeli leaders outrageous. He added, "We will always stand with Israel against threats to its security."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.